we turn to Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg, continuing their conversation from last week with Marty Hart Landsberg about the Green New Deal and lessons from the original New Deal, which in the 1930s had only begun to pull the U.S. out of the Depression, which only ended with the great mobilization of all resources and person power to fight World War II. The second part discusses how the Depression movements strengthened during the war and then won most of the New Deal programs we know, including Social Security and unemployment insurance. They also discuss how today's Green New Deal must confront a capitalist crisis that cannot be solved by jump-starting growth. We must quickly move to a very different economic model.
And so what happened is Roosevelt, who thought that his first New Deal might satisfy, was now being faced with not only continued unemployed organizing demanding relief and jobs, relief workers organizing demanding improvement and relief, and a labor movement that was now demanding unions, and in fact, all of those movements.
Wages, jobs, shorter hours, minimum wage, unemployment insurance.
Yeah, and also showing that when you launch a general strike, you're saying the rules are no longer going to be the rules. That it's essentially saying workers are going to be establishing and determining what power looks like. And the same with unemployed organizing and relief organizing who are engaging in strikes, disregarding laws, challenging the police and the courts. And it was this kind of pressure that led Roosevelt, with his advisor saying to him, something has to be done in 35 to launch what was called the Second New Deal.
Or we're going to have a revolution in this country.
This is the danger.
Yes.
So the question is then, from a Green New Deal point of view, how do you prepare people right now to understand how real significant change unfolds? It wasn't that the movement said, well, the capitalists are against us, let's ask for just a little with the hopes that we can expand it. Rather, it was a movement that demanded something meaningful, like real job creation, real relief, real Social Security. And when it didn't get it, it was able to continue to build, to continue to demand those things.
Yeah. And that led then to Roosevelt's second term, where, and we can call it, you call it the Second New Deal, I guess that's what the literature calls it. A lot of programs were passed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that, like, let's say, the minimum wage was passed in 1938, Fair Labor Standards Act. Mm-hmm. The minimum wage then was 25 cents an hour, the federal minimum wage. No states or anybody else had a minimum wage. 25 cents an hour was not enough even then to buy food. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it only covered 20% of the workers.
Yeah.
Well, they had a minimum wage, but it affected almost nothing.
Yeah.
And the Social Security was exactly the same. They were forced to pass a Social Security, but why don't you discuss the limitations?
I think this is where it becomes complicated, because these were path-breaking programs. Before Roosevelt, the government had never assumed responsibility for relief or job creation, had never invested in a Social Security system or even a system of labor laws and regulations protecting workers. So on the one hand, these were victories. On the other hand, the movement was well aware that what they got was not what they were asking for. So even when you think of the WPA, which has built post offices and all these wonderful things.
And Timberline Lodge.
Yep, the WPA paid wages below the market because they didn't want to draw people from the private sector. They refused to engage in any production that would challenge private activity or private markets. And they also continued to demand that the only people who could be eligible were people who were seen as financially needy, which meant that they had, much like our welfare system today, lots of punitive evaluations of finance. The government did pass a Social Security, but it was pushed because there was a bill that had actually come out of a House Congress that the left had supported that said everybody, whether they were unemployed or old or injured, should get paid an amount that was equivalent to kind of a living wage. And it was from the moment that they were unemployed or injured or reached a certain old age, and that the federal government would finance it. And that would be an unemployment system and a Social Security system, and they would be integrated, and they would be financed by taxes on the wealthy. What Roosevelt, when he saw that bill come into Congress,
that's un-American.
He immediately asked his own people to write a different Social Security bill that he could pass. And so what you got was unemployment and Social Security that wouldn't start for about 6 years. Here we are in the middle of the Depression. That from the point of view of unemployment was a given based on how much you had earned in your lifetime and how long you worked, which worked against people striking. And Social Security, again, was tied to your earnings and limited in certain ways. So in each of these kinds of things, the movement did succeed. They did make the country better. They did make the country fairer. But one of the lessons is, even in this period of massive uprising with a government that you might think is sympathetic, the response was always limited. And unfortunately, for reasons that, you know, become complicated, the movement, partly dictated by changing politics, the war, the movement wasn't able to go on and push to make changes in those. And so as a consequence, we ended up with a Social Security system that never fulfilled its promise and, of course, is under attack now. And we lost...
This was before the war, though, and before the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
When, in fact, Social Security became meaningful because those movements continued.
Well, it basically, you know, it evolved from the Roosevelt plan, which never reached the promise of what the political movements were really had written in a bill that would have created a much more stable, secure system that would be financed by wealthy people, not working people self-financing. So, you know, what's the importance here is that those who are advocating a Green New Deal often project all sorts of policies. We need governments to channel funds. We need to think about support programs for agriculture. We need new mass transit vehicles and new mass transit systems. We need new tax systems. And
we need radical conservation of energy. We need a new forestry. We need regenerative agriculture, radically changing the agribusiness practices. It's a very radical program,
actually. And it's going to require changes in every single sector of our economy and our lives.
And our lives,
yes. So then the question is, in the 30s, there was a very clear crisis of people's living conditions, and an unemployed movement was able to grow and project its power in particular ways. Now we face the question, how do houseless people organize? How do hungry people organize? How do farmers organize? What are the ways in which people were able to organize and create a national framework? We don't have one party, like, say, the Communist Party or the Socialist Party or the Mustaites, but we do have ways of linking together. And when you go back to the 30s and start thinking about these things, we can begin to sort of become aware of the challenges we face and start thinking about how we build movements in constituencies of people who need to be part of the process of change. And how do we create overall frameworks that allow them to begin to make changes locally, but push power up so that the needs we have begin to exercise control? And how do we create a movement that knows the lessons of the 1930s that is going to be continual pressure in making demands and holding governments accountable to get the kind of transformative policies we want? It's not a matter of just writing the policy and electing some progressive government of leadership that's going to do this. That the lessons of the 30s can teach us about how to prepare for the back and forth of state policy, the challenges of what slogans do you use? How do you connect people together? How do you assuage their fears? How do you create context for people, in fact, most importantly, to understand why they're in the precarious position that they're in?
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marty Hart Landsberg, who has a distinguished career at Lewis and Clark, wrote many important books, and does a blog now. He's still very, very active in Portland organizations, Jobs with Justice and Portland Rising. We've been talking about the lessons of his latest contribution on his blog on the economic front.
It's reports from the economic front.
Reports from the economic front.
Right. So
I always put Marty Hart Landsberg economic front.
Right.
I
will get it.
I get it. Anyway, we've been talking about the lessons of the New Deal, the 1930s and 40s and 50s. We didn't get quite to the 50s in the New Deal. And the way that it developed and the demands from below, from huge amounts of organizing with affected workers and non-affected workers, even people with jobs, but it was a vast undertaking and organizing project that continued and built multiple organizations in many areas making demands. It was after the war, though, the Depression never ended until Pearl Harbor. And then the U.S. entered the war. There was this mobilization. They drafted huge numbers of people. Everybody in the U.S. had a job. Yeah. The defense plants were booming, going 24 hours a day. They nationalized the auto industry, basically. No more cars were being built. Right. They were building tanks and planes. With new people, a lot of the auto workers were abroad fighting the war. Mm-hmm. Lots of women who everybody thought, they can't work, or they're just housewives. You know, that's the order of things. Suddenly, all these blacks were getting jobs, too. Poor black people from the South came up north to finally get a decent job in Portland, in the Kaiser, what do they build? Boats.
Shipyard.
In the shipyards. Suddenly, all of them, the whole of you, they were dying for labor. Everybody got a job who could walk upright. Mm-hmm. And these were people who were thought to be just hopeless and useless. That's why we have unemployment in the United States, said the capitalists. These people just are unemployable. They haven't taken the opportunities of American life. Suddenly, they all became employable, and they became this sort of they built the industry that beat the Nazis, basically. Mm-hmm. Huge defense plants and were built and staffed by people who had never, ever, didn't have any education whatsoever, actually. In any event, the war sort of took the U.S. out of the Depression. But after the war, all of these laws that were so inadequate to stop the Depression through the Roosevelt period suddenly became, the movements remained. The labor movement was, of course, had grown during that period, and they were under attack, including the labor movement is one that didn't, in fact, benefit after the war in the 50s. The Taft-Hartley Act was... Labor was cut back. The Congress is doing everything they could to stop workers from organizing, even though the organizing continued. But many other programs were tremendously expanded, right? The movements kept struggling. Democratic politicians, the New Deal politicians, had learned that the people want these movements and that we can afford them. Social Security became real. Unemployment insurance became real. The minimum wage even became real.
Well, I would agree, but I would modify it a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, but the main point you're making is, though, that I do agree fully that the New Deal did not solve the Great Depression. In fact, in 1937, the economy went down in 29 to a low point in 33, and then where unemployment was like 28%. And it went up from 33 to 37 to the high point where unemployment was only like 15%. And then Roosevelt said, well, okay, now we can cut back spending. Still that conservative, balanced budget. It shows how difficult it is to change ideology, that the elites really hold on to a kind of vision of the world that benefits them. And so he tightened up, and the economy went back into a recession, where unemployment hit about 20% by 38, and Roosevelt finally agreed to start spending. But even by 1940, unemployment was still like about 12 or 15%. So, the economy was certainly better than it was in 29, and there were certainly now some programs that ameliorated some of the worst, but it was far from out of the woods. But it was the buildup for the war and then the war that really brought the massive deficits and spending and brought the economy out of the Depression. And I think part of that also meant that a lot of these movements, these really mass movements, lost their connections, their strength, their alternative vision. I mean, the war provided different opportunities for employment, so the unemployed movement and the relief movement went away, and the more radical edge to the labor movement, which was really pushing with a different vision of worker control and how industry should operate.
Got put in jail.
Well, pushed out as part of the Cold War.
Right.
But also more conservative leaders could say, there's no need for that. Look how well the system functions.
Things at that period, the system was functioning for average workers. That was a period where a unionized manufacturing worker could buy a home, that was another program of that the U.S. was forced into, of guaranteeing low mortgage rates for people to buy homes. They realized that it was smart to have people to have people home ownership rather than rentals. It sort of kept. It was stabilizing for the economy. It's really good. That's what they say, you know, we need a middle class that's stabilizing. Well, this isn't a middle class. It was a working class, but it was a working class that was able to buy homes and a car and send their kid to the local university on one salary, a manufacturing worker. Yeah. That's all gone. I mean, it's been destroyed over the years. Mm-hmm. But in that period, it's sort of called, I think, by some economists, the golden age for the working class. Mm-hmm. It lasted until the late 70s before the terrible cut before capital really took over, regained power again, and managed to divert all income streams to itself. Mm-hmm. Right. Since 73, workers have declined.
Yep.
Anyway, but it seems to me that you could see why it was difficult to employ people when they were out taking and you had a 2-week vacation when they were going out to the beach on weekends. And playing in their little leagues and having this whole life and moving to the suburbs. Of course, blacks were another matter. This was the white working class that was doing better. But even some blacks were able to sort of stabilize their communities in that period. And they were under enormous attack, of course. But you could see why the movements declined. I mean, then for so many reasons, conservative people took over the labor movement.
Sure. Well, and that's where... I mean, I'm absolutely right. And so that's why some of the demands for direct public employment, which were part of the popular movement's demands, which were not really fully realized in the WPA, but were still on the agenda, get lost. That's why, you know, some of the more radical notions of the labor movement get lost. That doesn't mean that the period of the New Deal was inconsequential, which I know you're not saying. And so there is a reason why we can look back and say popular movements can shift state policy in substantial ways. The Roosevelt administration was forced to innovate and experiment in certain ways. The system is powerful, and there were limits on what even Roosevelt desired to do. But one of the lessons that we can learn when we're facing this big crisis is that movement building has the potential to shift policy. Governments won't shift policy on their own, and it's not a smooth process. And so again, I go back to the Green New Deal and the excitement. It's so inspiring to see people come out and demand a Green New Deal and to be in the streets. But to really have the political force to push a transformative set of state policies is going to take organizing. And those are the kinds of challenges that people who are in movements now or who are in communities trying to join people together have to start thinking about, because it's not that we're going to recreate exactly what other people did, but many of the challenges are the same. How do you find times to connect people? How do we do actions that, in the context of the action, educate people on why they're so precarious, why different ways of living will be superior? What are the obstacles? What are the class forces opposing these things? How do we begin to project a different vision? And that's where I think the New Deal period has a lot to teach us, not to romanticize it, but not to dismiss it, but to see a period in U.S. history of massive organizing under very difficult circumstances that succeeded in transforming a political environment.
Marty Hart Landsberg, That's the last word. We learned a lot about the necessity of organizing now, of the unwillingness of the capitalist class to give much. But they can, in fact, be forced to give something, and sometimes those things that they give are models of a very, very different future. And that's what could happen, it seems to me, at least in this period. We may not, in fact, get what we want, but we will get some of what we want, and we will get models of what we want. Those models are already being developed in some cities and around the country.
It's very important.
And when the crisis then hits again, it could hit soon, but we do have the power to create these models now and these programs, real operating models of energy production, of agriculture, in every sphere, actually, buildings.
Yeah. And I think that's worthy of celebrating, that the notion of a Green New Deal, whatever people mean by it, has really taken root and is inspiring people to think about different ways of living and working and relating in all these spheres. And I think that's something to really build on and to celebrate.
Yeah, we have to just keep fighting for those radical programs, because we can, in fact, win many of the elements of what would be a really transformed society. And it's necessary.
Yep, absolutely. Because it is a crisis. And if we can't
nature,
solve it in a positive way, we are going to be continuing to suffer, more of us, more seriously.
And maybe, in fact, wind up with humans no longer on the planet if we don't stop climate change. Capital is in deep, deep trouble. They either have to be transformed, or we're probably going to suffer far more than we ever could imagine, in fact, even that Hollywood imagines. Martin Hart Landsberg, I grabbed the last word. You want the last word, right?
No, go for it.
Is that all right? I didn't want to end on that, though. That's, in fact, one possibility. The other possibility is something really a transformed society in very, very interesting and democratic
and
ways.
And transform people in the process that really can make for a new world real in ways that I think most of us, and certainly all of KBOO listeners, would want.
Once again, go to Reports from the Economic Front. It was great talking to you.
Thanks. I appreciated the chance to talk with you about this, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.